Chapter 21. December 21st, dawn. The depths. As soon as Martin and Trevor had left, Wiley had found himself able to write again. He and Brooke read over what he had just completed. "Did they drown?" she asked. "God forbid. The key thing here is that Al North knows something that can help them, but his soul is here, still on this side. So if he thinks about it clearly enough, I'm going to pick up on it, I think." She sat reading the screen, scrolling, then reading more. "Is he... what's happening to him? What's he sinking into?" "My best guess is the core of the planet. Maybe the way you live makes your soul weigh more or less. If you weigh too much, have too little love and too much greed, essentially, you sink. And then I guess you just stay there, trapped, cooking, given that the core is hot. But the universe has an end. What then? I think the evil are forgotten. But we need him. We need him now." Outside, dawn was breaking. The last phoebes were calling, the last tanagers chirping. Winter, such as it was, would drive them south any day now. They were very late to leave this year, but there was not much winter now, so they would return by February. She came closer to him. He closed the laptop. "Nick?" she called softly. No answer. "Kelsey?" Silence. But then she moved away. "I can feel him. He's not going down. He's here." "The world is full of watchers. We're all on stage all the time. I want privacy." These past days had isolated them from each other, but he had learned something from what he was seeing of Al North's miserable afterlife. Love is the great treasure. It is what we come here to feel, and every bit of it that can be taken must be taken, because it isn't like the other acts of life. Most everything is forgotten in death. The names, the facts, the achievements, the failures, all are left behind. But love is not left behind. Jacob's ladder has another name in heaven. It is love. She folded her arms, their signal that it wasn't the right moment. "I feel too exposed," she said. "We are but players," he said. "I can't do it on stage. Anyway, my mind is blown. Martin and Trevor, my dear God, what's happening to them now?" He took her in his arms. She lay against him, and it was good for a time in the quiet. Soon, though, he felt something other than the beat of her heart. He raised his head. "What is that?"
"Trembling. I think, the fridge?"
But it got stronger. Things began to rattle. "Dad!"
"All right, everybody stay calm," he shouted.
In her room, Kelsey began crying.
"Hold on, honey!"
He wasn't going anywhere. The house was now shaking and shuddering so hard that he couldn't take a step. There was a tremendous crash from downstairs. He thought that the chandelier in the dining room must have collapsed, or the gun cabinet gone over in the family room. "Try to get out!" he shouted. Behind him, Brooke vomited. He grabbed her and forced one foot in front of the other, dragging her toward the bedroom door and the stairs. Nick appeared, incredibly, with Kelsey in his arms. The sight of them galvanized Brooke, who took her little girl and they went lurching down the back stairs. The family room was in chaos. It had indeed been the guns. Now windows began shattering, their glass exploding into the house. Nick got the back door open and they struggled out onto the deck, which was soaked because the pool had heaved most of its water out and the rest was splashing crazily. The woods presented a chilling spectacle with all the limbs swaying and a continuous thunder of cracking trunks and the sighing rumble of falling trees. They got to the middle of the backyard, well away from the house, well away from the woods. The quake had been going now for at least 2 minutes, maybe three, but it felt like years. It felt like forever. There was another crash from inside the house, and the lights in Nick's room flickered. Wiley put his arm across his son's shoulders. His bunk bed had just collapsed. Just one sound then, choking, astonished sobs. Brooke, staring at her house in horrified amazement. The quake had ended. "This is Kansas," she said, her voice an awed whisper.
"Barish had a heart attack," Kelsey announced.
Then, her voice careful,
"I'm quite concerned about him."
Wiley was looking back into the woods, where he was seeing flickering. "I think we have a fire going back in there," he said.
"Call the fire department,"
Brooke responded as she headed toward the house. He watched his family go in, heard Brooke scream her rage when she saw the mess, heard Kelsey start to cry, then Nick's calmer voice giving instructions. The flickering was along the draw that drifted south down from the ridge they were on. For their view, they had paid a price, because if there was ever a fire in that draw, it would be here in minutes. Knowing this, he had prepared himself with a portable water tank, which he kept in the garage. He'd tested it, and it worked well, but it was not huge, so the key was to reach the fire early. The tank was behind his car, wedged against the wall. Worse, the garage door was jammed. Fine, he was ready for that, too. He strode across the garage and got his axe, which was lying in a heap of other tools. When he'd bought this, he'd imagined that he would take out a few trees himself, thin his woods by the sweat of his brow. Not. He hefted it and smashed it into one of the doors. The mechanism shook, and Nick appeared.
"What are you doing?"
"I gotta get down to that fire."
"Here."
He reached up and pulled a lever Wiley hadn't even known was there. Then he lifted the door. The mechanism had been locked up because the power was out. Nick began pulling the fire pump out.
"Look, you stay with the girls. I'll go down."
"Dad!"
"Nick, please. You have to. They need one of us."
"What just happened, Dad? We don't have earthquakes here."
"I know it. Whatever it was, it's got to do with that fire down there."
Nick went in the house, reappeared immediately with the Magnum.
"Take this, Dad. I've got everything loaded up and we're going to be in the family room."
Wiley took the Magnum, stuffed it in his belt, and headed out to fight the fire. He loped down the rough little draw, the pumper bouncing along behind him on its two bicycle wheels. As he got closer, the glow became more distinct. Would 50 gallons of water be enough? And in any case, what was burning? The electrics came up the road on the other side of the ridge. He pushed his way along a jumbled path, slowing down as he got closer to the glow. When he broke through into the clearing, he didn't even bother to unhook the hose, let alone pump up the tank. For a good half minute, he had to struggle to make sense of what he was seeing. It looked like a doorway into a little room. He walked closer, his feet crunching in the dry autumn grass. It was a little room. He could see it clearly. But what the hell was it doing out here? It was like an opening into a tiny cottage, and he thought maybe he knew where the stories of the witch house in the forest came from. It had come with the earthquake, this strange opening, perhaps because of the quake, or maybe its coming had caused the quake. It was about 6 feet high and 3 feet wide. From inside, there glowed hard light that came from a single bulb hanging down from the room's ceiling. He went closer yet. He was now standing directly before the room. Another step, and he would be inside. On the right, he saw a rough table with a bowl on it. The bowl was filled with hot soup. He could see it steaming. To his left was a narrow bed covered by a gray, damp-looking sheet. On the opposite wall there was a window, which was blocked by a thin drape. Beyond it, he detected movement, but could see no detail through the frayed cloth. It seemed very sad, the little room, somebody's little hutch. But where was it, exactly? Experimentally, he pushed his hand in the doorway. There was a faint pop, nothing more. Immediately, though, his hand felt warm. It felt damp. Slowly, he moved it back and forth and observed what was without question one of the most bizarre things he had ever seen. His hand moved more slowly than his wrist, meaning that when his moving arm reached the center of the doorway, his hand was a good 2 feet behind it. There was no pain, and there was no sense of detachment, but the hand simply did not appear to keep up with the arm. He snatched his hand back. Was he, perhaps, looking into a room in Abaddon? If so, then this might be a major opportunity. There were controls in Abaddon that kept the 14 huge lenses that were the main gateways open into the other human world. Tonight, the Seraph would pour through them in their billions. Disrupt those controls, and you would set the Seraph back. The gateways, which would be wide open tonight, would begin to close. By the 25th, they would be closed entirely, not to reopen again for all those thousands of years. The secret of Christmas was that the birth of goodness came on the day that the door to evil was closed. This was a gateway, and that little room was in Abaddon. He knew where, of course. It was General Sampson's apartment. The earthquake had been local. It had involved the opening of this gateway. Should he go through? Dare he? It must be a trap, a temptation. Then he noticed that the glow was less. This very unusual gateway was closing. It could be an opportunity. It was here that the Seraph had originally attacked him. Except no, there was something wrong with that picture. As soon as his memories flitted back to that night, he saw Brooke and Nick and Kelsey coming up from the draw with him, and everybody was happy. They were thrilled. He was thrilled. What? He'd been raped by Seraph marauders in this draw, trying to claw their way into a human universe that had rejected them. The glow was dropping fast. He stepped up to the gateway. The room on the other side looked now more like a photograph than an actual opening. He stepped forward and found that the surface was now thick, that it felt like stepping into a molten wall. He pushed against it, pushed harder. It was like squeezing through a mass of rubber. And then he was stumbling forward. He tried to check himself, but windmilled across and hit the far wall hard. He sank down, feeling as if all his blood had been drained right out of him. Then the noise hit him. Coming from outside was the most ungodly screeching and roaring he had ever heard in his life. Machinery howled, voices squalled and screamed, high and rasping and utterly alien, but not the voices of animals, no. They were shouting back and forth in a complex language, oddly peppered with any number of human words, English included. Worse, they were close by. This was a ground-floor apartment. A greasy stink of sewage and boiled meat came from the blood-red soup. The fact that it was still steaming worried him, of course, because whoever's dinner it was would be back for it at any moment. It must be Samson's food, meaning that he was here. Recalling the story of the three bears and the little girl who had entered their woodland cabin and found their meal ready to eat, he thought that others had passed through gateways like this before. In fact, if you read it right, you could reconstruct the entire fairy faith of Northern Europe as a chronicle of contacts with Abaddon. He could either leave here now and try to make his way to Government House, or he could lie in wait for that monster. Maybe he should try to steal Samson's car. But it had a soul, didn't it? So maybe it wouldn't be so willing to let itself be stolen. The safest thing would be to lie in wait. There weren't many places to hide in the room, just a curtain that concealed a still toilet full of puke-yellow goop that was being swarmed by flies as fat as ticks and as red as a baboon's ass. Or no, look at the things, they weren't flies at all. They were tiny damn bats. He could not hide in there. He could not be near that toilet, which had, among other things, part of a rotting seraph hand in it. He knew that they were cannibals, of course. He'd seen this place before, had heard Samson think to himself that the execution fiesta he'd witnessed from the bus would mean lots of soup. So, this was some of that soup. But where was Samson? It had to be getting cold, even in the jungle heat they had here. Maybe he'd been arrested. Could have happened in a heartbeat. Maybe he was being tortured to death right now by that sociopathic kid of Echidnas. The shrieking rose, and with it came thudding from above. There were crunching noises, more cries, then a sound outside the door of somebody running downstairs. The sobs were unmistakable. A short silence followed. Then, more slowly, a heavier tread. It moved past the door. This was not good. If somebody came in here, they'd raise the alarm and... Well, he dared not allow his imagination to go there. He decided this had been a fool's errand. The soup was a trick. Samson was actually on the other side, and he was going to be menacing Brooke and Nick and Kelsey. It was obvious. And what a damn fool he'd been. He turned to go back through the gateway. Except there was no gateway. For a moment, he simply stared at the blank wall. The door clicked. He watched the crude wooden handle rise slowly. There was a flicker and a sputter, and he realized that the sharp light wasn't even electric. It was carbide, a type of gas that had been used at home 150 years ago. They didn't even have electricity. The door swung open. A gleaming creature stood there, shimmering purple-black. The vertical pupils in its eyes were bright red, the irises gold. It had in its hand a small disc with two barrels on the business end. Wiley knew what that was, and he decided not to show the magnum just now. Slowly, carefully, he raised his hands. The creature smiled a little, a tired smile.
"I've been waiting for you,"
it said in a rasping voice. Its English was good enough, but spoken with a curious sing-song lilt that made Wiley think of the voice of a car. Wiley had been outmaneuvered. "Where's Samson?"
"He is with your loved ones, Mr. Dale."
Wiley knew what the phrase "to die a thousand deaths" really meant. In a situation like this, it was no cliché, but a dark expression of truth. The creature made a very curious sound, a sort of smacking. It watched him with ghastly eagerness. He thought that they might be allergic to human dander, but they could eat human flesh, and this thing was hungry.
"At this time, come with me."
What else was there to do? Wiley followed the creature down a steep, narrow staircase that reeked of something that had rotted dry. The walls were covered with graffiti, squiggles and lines that looked at first meaningless, and then didn't. They were drawings, all at child level, but done with the light and dark backward, like photographic negatives. For the most part, they were scenes of torture and murder and orgy. Some drawings showed male seraph with stick-like penises, others females with bared teeth guarding black eggs. And as they came to the street, he saw some of them. One that looked up was the same color as Jennifer Maisel, creamy and pale, her scales glittering. Her eyes were the same as those of his captor. She gave Wiley a long, melting look as she slowly ran her tongue out and touched it with her fingers.
"A whore," his guard said.
Then some boys appeared, wearing hugely oversized T-shirts painted with images of crocodile-like creatures so perfectly rendered that they seemed about to leap off the cloth and into his face, some of them. One had a New Sex Pistols T-shirt, obviously from home. Another, a shirt with a big green fruit on it in the shape of a bitten apple, and in the bite, an image of a squeezed human face. This one carried a brutal weapon, an Aztec sword made of steel with obsidian blades jutting out of it. The squeezed face was instantly familiar. It was Adolf Hitler. They watched him with their brilliant dead eyes, their heads moving with the clipped jerks of lizards. As he walked, he saw that the street was made of wood. In fact, of cut tree trunks fitted together with an Inca's skill. Before them was a vehicle looking something like a horse-drawn hearse, but with a tiny barred window in the back instead of glass to reveal the coffin. Standing in its equipage was a brown animal with fearsome, glaring eyes and purple drool dripping from its long, complex jaw. The jaw itself was metal, and appeared to be partially sprung the way it dangled. The animal was smaller than a horse by half, but seemed made entirely of brown, wiry muscle with the narrow, ever-twisting neck of a snake. When it saw them, it began to burp and stomp pointed, spike-like feet, which made it look as if it was dancing. Others, just like it, pulling various wagons and carriages, moved up and down the street. The door at the back of the wagon was open, and his captor made a brisk little gesture toward it and bowed. A twisted smile played on his almost lipless mouth, and his spiked teeth glittered in the brown light. There was a hissing sound overhead, and he saw, soaring past, a gorgeous green machine shaped like a horizontal teardrop, with a gleaming windshield at the front of its perfectly streamlined shape. It was so different from the miserable mess in the street that it was hard to believe that it even belonged to the same world. Then he got a terrific push, which caused him to bark his shins painfully against the edge of the wagon's floor. He tried to turn toward his assailant, but a powerful blow brought whizzing confusion. The door shut behind him with a dry clunk. For a moment, he could see nothing. As his eyes got used to the dimness, he examined the space he was in. It was like nothing so much as the interior of an old, zinc-lined ice chest. It was at most 3 feet high and 5 long. There were claw marks gouged in the roof and walls, and in the wooden floor places, many of them, that had been gnawed. He drew out the magnum, cradling it in his hand as he would the rarest diamond. This was hope. He twisted himself around until he could see out one of the tiny barred windows. They were not going up the great esplanade he had seen through Samson's eyes, but along the city's back streets. There were neon hieroglyphics everywhere, and flags overhead with more unreadable slogans on them. The place was ancient Egypt on steroids. Martin would have loved it, but he wasn't the sucker on the spot, was he? No, indeed, and the fear had a funny quality to it. The fear had to do with more of the knowledge he had gained. He had a soul. These people could take out your soul and put it in a damn glass tube. They could remove your memories and graft them into their own souls, eat them, as it were. They could use you for crap like running a car, and God only knew what else. In this place, the phrase, the soul in the machine, had a ghastly new meaning. They went around the corner. The animal was not fast, and began to pass what appeared to be a restaurant. Behind the lighted windows, he could see gleaming red walls and a gold ceiling. Balls of light, floating in mid-air, provided illumination. Sitting in large chairs were seraphs in beautiful, shimmering suits tight against their bodies. Then he got what could probably and with accuracy be called the surprise of his life. There were human beings in there, too. As they trundled slowly past, he strained to see more. There was a man in a fur jacket and a white ermine fedora, not recognizable to him, but obviously some kind of entertainer, maybe a rapper or a rock star. There were women in silks and furs. Other men wore tuxedos, some business suits, others caftans and galabias. Then he saw a cardinal, distinguished by the red zucchetto on his head and the red-trimmed black cassock. On the tables before them were golden dishes, beautifully decorated with garlands of greenery and white flowers. Heaped on them were roasted body parts, both seraph and human. The diners were eating busily. Then it was gone, replaced by more of the endless gray city and its hurrying, oblivious hordes of seraph. A stunned Wiley Dale sank down to the floor. For a time, he lay there listening to the creak of the axles, feeling the steady swaying of the wagon. His blank mind held an image of that cardinal, of the men in tuxedos, the women in evening gowns. Who, in the name of all that was holy, were they? Rich, to be sure, compared to the starved horde that crowded these streets. Human beings, movers and shakers all, living large in hell. Or was that the whole answer? The seraph were chameleons, so maybe these weren't human beings at all, but seraph spending time at home. Two Moon Earth must have been plagued by them. It had totally ignored air pollution, and global warming was running wild there, even worse than at home. Shape-shifted seraph had probably been running the place for centuries. They were the cardinals, the big personalities, the ministers and the kings. Like Samson, he'd ended up in control of the United States itself, and he was a shape-shifted reptilian seraph maintaining himself on drugs. He wondered who in his own world might be a seraph in disguise. Who sought the ruin of souls? Who encouraged greed? Who lived by the lie that pollution didn't matter? Who, indeed? He realized that he was not far from insanity here. His mind just wanted to go inside itself. Walk in the green fields of dream, smell the flowers, above all, shut this horrible world out, scrub his brain free of all knowledge of it and memory of it. Every trembling cell of his body, every instinct that he had, every drop of his blood said the same thing. You are not supposed to know this. You are not supposed to be here, and you cannot get away. And to keep their secret, they are going to kill not just your body, but your immortal soul. But now that he had fallen into the trap, he must not freeze. He had to do everything possible to turn their trick back on them. He had to try. Oh God, he prayed. What is the universe? How does it really work? Above all, how can I save this situation? A memory came to him of Martin and his ceaseless prayer, and he began to pray that way also. he prayed to the healing hand that had raised Osiris after his brother had cut him to pieces, and Jesus after his passion had ended. The unseen one who bound the good by the cords of love. They were arriving somewhere, the wagon turning, stopping. He looked out first one window and then the other, but saw only skeletal trees, huge once, no doubt, rich with leaves and life, now gray and dead, clawing at the brown sky.
"Mr. Dale, if you don't mind?"
As Wiley came down, the creature added,
"I was wondering if you'd autograph Alien Days for me."
For the love of Pete, it had a paperback of the damn book and a pen in its clawed hand. Too stunned to do anything else, he took the book, opened it to the title page.
"Do you want me to personalize it?"
"Oh, hey, yeah. Make that out to me."
Confused, he looked up, to find himself staring into a very human and very familiar face. Senator Lewis Bowles, Chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Senior Senator from Utah. Senator Bowles smiled, then shuddered, and shifted back into a long-faced vampiric horror, its scales glistening, its eyes glaring with evil energy. He finished the inscription. "To Senator Bowles." And as he did so, saw the hand that was doing the writing, and then also the hand that was holding the book. He saw long, thin fingers of the palest tan, ending in black claws, neatly manicured. He saw the wrists, where they were visible outside the sleeves of his jacket, narrow, scaled, shimmering with the gemstone sheen of snakeskin. He looked at the hand that held his Mont Blanc, turned it over, watching the light play on the scales. Then he raised his fingers to his cheek and felt beneath their tips the delicate shudder of more scales. He hadn't come to an alien Earth at all. He was a shapeshifter himself. He had come home. Part 4. The Blue Light. He found the blue light and made her a signal to draw him up again. She did draw him up, but when he came near the edge, she stretched down her hand and wanted to take the blue light away from him. "No," said he, perceiving her evil intention. "I will not give you the light until I am standing with both feet upon the ground." The witch fell into a passion, let him fall again into the well, and went away. The Brothers Grimm, The Blue Light.
"How long, Yahweh, will you forget me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long shall I take counsel in my soul, having sorrow in my heart every day? How long shall my enemy triumph over me?"
Psalm 13:1-2. Chapter 22. December 21st, evening. The Chapel Perilous. Outside the tent, the night bellowed. Earthquakes had started right after they had come back from Wiley's universe and were continuous now, a low shuddering that never stopped. On other parts of the planet, Martin and Trevor knew from reading Wiley's book, this meant that hell was unfolding. The Seraph were racing to sink the great human cities and most of the human lands and raise the ocean floors that would be their new continents. They had only hours left until the 14 artificial gateways they had constructed around the world opened wide and a billion hungry Seraph came swarming through. Three times now, the little band had heard the unearthly scream of tornadoes in the sky, then the bone-shaking thudding that followed when they hit and went marching off across the prairie. Pam and George had had the presence of mind to locate the tent close to the foot of a small hill, meaning that they were unlikely to take a direct hit from a tornado. But if a big one should sweep this clearing, well, then it was over for them. Thunder snapped, the wind screamed, and Ward and Claire James drummed on their drums. Outriders chuckled and rasped nearby. Martin believed that they probably didn't even want to attack the tent at this point. They wanted this little band of evolved humans right where they were, because as long as they were here, what problems could they cause? He and Trevor had almost been drowned when the Hummer passed through the gateway and hit the flood on this side. But the other kids had anticipated what might happen and were waiting with ropes in the slow water near shore. It had been a near thing, but the both of them had managed to ford the swollen, raging river. Trevor slept with his head on his dad's shoulder. Another kid had the other shoulder. Two little ones shared his lap. And he thought, working in his mind with Pam and George and Mike. The kids were getting expert at this, their minds racing much, much faster than his. The change had affected children and adolescents, because their minds were more supple and less informed with the weight of civilized knowledge. There was a name for the state they were in, many names, in fact. It was called Bodhi, Satori, many things, but it was not as if the soul was lit from a higher power, enlightened. They weren't enlightened. They simply were. Man had left the forests of Eden an animal, but these kids had found their way back, bringing none of the debris of civilization, but all of its compassion, its consciousness of the value of the individual, its ability to balance personal and collective need. They had returned to Eden as true human beings. They understood how to be as lilies of the field. For them, it wasn't impossible to live in the rain. They had each other. They had love. But they were still just this tiny little band in a great and frightened world. It had been this way before, he thought, in the lands of southern France and northern Spain 30,000 years ago, when the spirit had been on the children and adolescents had begun to paint the walls of caves with the magic animals of the mind. Pam shook him. She frowned at him. He'd allowed his mind to drift while they were reading his memories of Wiley's book. "See them?" Trevor asked suddenly. His voice was curiously flat, as if he was dreaming. "Are you asleep, son?" "I'm out of my body, and if I keep having to talk, I'm going to be back in, so come out. I need to show you something." Pam nodded. They could read the information stored in his brain in peace if he wasn't there. So he took a deep breath, let it out, and with it, let his soul out of his body. When he moved out of the tent, he found Trevor and some of the other kids together. The rain whipped through them. The outriders did not react to them. He saw them as their ordinary selves, but knew that this was only his mind filtering their essences into familiar forms. Their bodies were still inside the tent. Trevor pointed, and he followed the direction. Moving slowly, he tried to clear himself of all expectation, to so empty his mind that the actual appearance of the world over which he was flying would come through. It was hard, though, in this state, to see anything except what you expected to see or wanted to. He saw cities, brightly lit in the night, Wichita and Kansas City, and the smiling prairie farther on dotted here and there with the lights of smaller communities. He saw, in other words, a safe world, and so one that was not real. So he told himself, "You will close yourself to this. You will blank your mind, and when you look again, you will not see your memories or your hopes. You will see only what is part of the actual physical world." He saw Lindy. He was right in front of her, and she was still walking, but she was so thin and tired, she looked like she had only a few more steps left in her. Her eyes were glazed as if dead, but still she walked, and not far ahead were lines of 14-wheelers, Continental van lines, Murphy's stores, Gap leaders, an ad hoc assembly of vehicles. Other wanderers were getting into them, and she was eager he could see it, because it would mean no more walking on her blistered clumps of feet. Soldiers, some of them in standard-issue GI uniforms, others thin and sleek, serif in gleaming black, their hands gloved in white, their heads hidden by visored helmets, were separating the arriving wanderers into two groups. Serif and human soldiers worked together, and he knew that the human soldiers were themselves wanderers. There was a crackle, and a group of wanderers who had just been moved into a small field blew apart, their legs, arms, and heads flying in every direction. Sitting in the back of a nearby pickup was a soldier manning a peculiar disc-shaped weapon, and he knew what that was, too, because back in the tent, Trevor had the smaller one he'd taken from Wiley's house. As he watched, more wanderers approached the ruined bodies with knives and saws and began harvesting the meat. The ever-thrifty Serif must be feeding their captives to themselves. It made ugly sense. How could you find a cheaper way to keep them going than that? He tried to scream at Lindy, but his voice could not be heard by her or anybody else. And look at her poor feet. Surely she wouldn't be set to work. Surely they would select her. And his poor Winnie, God only knew what had become of her. The sorrow was so great, the helplessness almost enough to drive him mad. A warmth came over him then, so kind, so surpassing in protective compassion that he allowed himself to hope that at last the deity he had been praying to constantly for all these days had come. But it was not God. It was another soul. He had a sense of a soldier's heart, determined, disciplined, and a soldier's face, tight with effort. When he tried to open himself to this soul, though, the way you do when you are practiced in out-of-body travel, and he was getting somewhat okay at it, the other soul threw up a memory from its childhood, a boy riding a bicycle up a driveway on a summer night, a yellow porch light with moths flying around it, an elderly dog standing up on the porch, then coming down to greet the boy, his tail twirling. Martin recognized it as an attempt to say, in the multi-layered language in which soul speaks to soul, that this visitor, who was trying to contact him now, had been a boy beloved of an old dog. And with the high-speed insight that characterizes thought unencumbered by the electrochemical filters built into the brain, Martin saw that this meant that he had once been good and gentle, but it was a long time ago. But he had seen his error, and now longed to return to his boyhood state. He had done evil, this interloper, but he was trying to say that he was not himself evil. Then Martin saw hieroglyphics. They were extremely vivid, but were they coming from the soul, or were they in the physical world? Telling the difference took an expert, and he was no expert. Trevor's mental voice said, "This is what I wanted you to see. Let General North continue to guide you." Martin saw the face of their guide again, just the eyes. The eyes were pleading. Martin could, of course, read hieroglyphics, but there were over 2,000 hieroglyphic symbols, and translation could be an extraordinary challenge, and the farther back in time from the date of the creation of the Rosetta Stone, which was the basis of all hieroglyphic translation, the less accurate translation became. He saw immediately that these were Old Kingdom, if not even older, and that they were a mix of words and numbers with bits of quickly scribbled hieratic notes here and there along the edges. These were the most complex hieroglyphics he had ever seen, but as with all complex texts, there were simpler words, and he thought to start with these. They were lovely glyphs, really well executed. He read the swallow glyph, then Udjet, the eye of Horus that has become the familiar RX of modern prescriptions. He read on, recognizing the name Narmor, the first pharaoh of the Old Kingdom. Then a bit of the hieratic text became clear. The connection. This was followed by an unknown number that had been scribbled beside the hieroglyphic for copper. Incredibly, this appeared to be a set of instructions about making electrical connections. The souls of the kids were filling the chamber now. Pam had come and was signaling an image of a long tunnel with some kind of a car in it. Then George showed a picture of the Rockies, then the entrance to the Cheyenne Mountain facility, easily recognizable by its huge steel doors. This image agitated Al North. Martin could feel his sorrow. But why? They knew that somewhere the human souls were stored, and maybe what they were learning here was that it was under the Rockies. A map was thrust into his mind as if into his hand, accompanied by a red flush of anger. It was a Google map, centered just west of Holcomb. A shock went through him. "Zoom," he said. Again. The map now pointed to a particular crossroads, and he at once understood why the Seraph had scoured this part of Kansas the way they had. It wasn't only because he was there, and the gateway to the other human world was there. It was because the repository where the souls were hidden was there. At the geographic center of the continental United States, which was a few miles from the town of Lebanon, just over the county line from Holcomb, just at the crossroads he was looking down at right now. This spot must be of enormous geomagnetic significance. But the men who had made the casual measurements that had located it had been innocently playing around with a cardboard map. But they hadn't. They had been under Seraph mind control and doing the work of Seraph engineers. He could feel Al North's delight as a sense of dancing. Music came out of him, joyous chords. He had been working and working to communicate this. He had been struggling to be seen, to be heard, but until now nobody had noticed him. Martin had not noticed that they'd gone down into the earth to find this place, but they had. They'd gone deep, and as they returned, traveling through so much stone was eerie. To feel yourself in the pull of it, to feel your sensitive electromagnetic body negotiating the smaller spaces in the dense matter, it was claustrophobic, and they were deep, very deep. Without warning, he burst up into the storms of the night and went rocketing into the sky. For an instant, he saw the wide plains of Kansas whirling beneath him, then the clouds. Then he was above the clouds, and the second moon was high, its soft light making castles of the cloud tops from horizon to horizon. He felt a pull upward, strong, and he saw laughing, singing children, looking down from a tower above him, pleading with him to come. But he looked only for one face in the Tower of Song, and he did not see that face. He did not see his Winnie. Above the tower were spreading mansions and roads in the high sky, great flowing blue spaces, and the clouds were gone, and the moons were gone, and waves of pure pleasure were pouring through his body with such intensity that he could not believe that he had anything even approaching such a capacity for delight. It was the pleasure of great love, mature and rich and filled with the resonance of long companionship, an exalted version of the love he had known with Lindy. But also there was somebody there who wanted him and to enter him and become him too. And there was the laughter of children and the perfect voice of a great choir. Then something stung him, hard, on the cheek. Dad! Dad! What was that? Well, it wasn't heaven, so he wasn't interested. Another sting, harder. No, go away. Another one, harder still. Damn you! Dad! Trevor was there. Physically, there. Because souls don't have beads of sweat running along their upper lips. Trevor shut his eyes tight and whap! Martin saw stars. What the hell? You hit me! His son fell on him, sobbing and laughing, hugging him. Finally! Dad, you almost didn't come back! He had never in his life felt as heavy as he did now. Returning to your body was putting on a lead overcoat. How long have I been? He bowed his head. He could not bear to say it. He had been in heaven. His son's hand touched his shoulder. I went there too, Dad. Martin shook his head. He didn't want to think, to talk, to listen to those damn drums anymore, to be here in this awful place. He wanted to be there, where flowers that bloomed forever never stopped surprising you. Eternity was not living in the same old world forever. It was discovering the world anew forever. "Where's the monument?" Trevor asked. "Who knows where it is?" A few hands went up. "It's off the roadside near Smith Center," Tim Grant said. "There's a chapel there that can seat like 20 people. It's all sort of nothing, actually. Except for the millions of souls that are trapped under there. According to Wiley's book, it's where General Al North was taken," Trevor said. "It might be under Kansas, but the entrance is in Colorado, at that base." Martin felt that Cheyenne Mountain didn't matter. It was just another Seraph trick, a diversion. No, the chapel would be the key. If they went there, they would find the vulnerability that the Seraph were trying to hide. "Thing is, the way they've scoured this part of Kansas, how interested they are in us, and we're just a quiet little corner of the world, after all. I'd say that if the monument is right above the center of their repository, then that's where we need to go to reach it. That's got to be their weak point." The atmosphere in the tent became electric. "It's not very far," a voice said. "We have to go in the physical," George added. "Or we won't be able to do anything in the physical." From outside came the chuckling clatter of the jaws of outriders. The drummers started drumming. "I'm going with you," Trevor said softly. Martin did not reply, not verbally. There would be no way to keep Trevor here. He stood up, and so did Trevor and so did Pam. But the others did not stand. He could sense something among them, a kind of mutual agreement, but it wasn't clear exactly what was in their minds. Mike stood. His girl cried out but stifled her cry. She came to her feet and threw her arms around him. They stood like this, the young couple, and Martin saw that their hearts were married. She stayed behind, though, surrounded by the little ones. The woods were quiet now, the outriders having gone off when they failed to smell fear here. To the west, lightning flickered. Would the storms never end? No,
Not as long as the Seraph tortured this poor earth, Martin knew. All of that seafloor that had risen would be gushing with methane from hydrates and billions of tons of dead marine life, and hydrogen sulfide and other gases he couldn't even name. In a matter of days, it would change the atmosphere, and the Seraph would be able to breathe easily here, and all the humans and most of the animals and insects would die. First Moon now rode in the high sky, its light bright and bitter, and the night was so still that you could hear the whisper of grass when breezes touched it. It was a sound familiar in Kansas when the crops were high and the night wind ran in them, sighing and whispering. "Stop," Mike said softly. Sensing trouble, Martin drew his prayer back into his mind. Trevor pointed upward. For a moment, Martin saw only the sky. Then, against the moon, a flash of darkness, ugly and ribbed like the wing of a bat. Then he saw another and another, and as his eyes began to track the movement in the sky, he understood that there was not one nighthawk circling up there, but dozens, no, hundreds, in a soaring column that seemed to go up forever, thousands in the moonlight. Something slid into Trevor's hand, and Martin knew what it was, that Seraph gun, even more fearsome than Wiley and Nick's arsenal. "All right," Mike said. "Right now, you're thinking away as usual, Dr. Winters, and the rest of us are absolutely not afraid. And the reason is, we're doing what you keep thinking about doing. You have to use the prayer, Dr. Winters. You have to keep it in your head all the time. And now, you're about to think about the Valley of Death and comfort yourself with the psalm, but please don't even do that." He recalled Franny's prayer, took it to his mind, and began repeating it. Of course, he was not even a believer. If anything, he was a Jeffersonian Christian, an admirer of the man, but not a believer in the resurrection. And in any case, Zoe had been right, had he not, that the prayer was itself a form of egotism. He realized that Mike was looking at him. They were all looking at him. The 14 parts of Osiris, the 14 stations of the cross, the 14 sacred sites, the 14 black lenses. "Do you understand now, Dr. Winters?" He nodded, but he did not understand. The great magic number of the past was 7, the number of a completed octave and a completed life. So what was 14? "The number of resurrection, the key to heaven," Trevor said. "And it's the resurrection energy that the Seraph hate, because it's what they can't have. That's why they steal souls, to find in their goodness a taste of heaven. That's why they're really here. It's not for bodies and land. It's for souls." They walked through the wrecked forest, past uprooted trees, through the yards of ruined houses, and he could see the white steeple of Third Street Methodist still standing. Also, they walked out from under the great column of nighthawks, which could not see them because they could not see any fear. They reached Pam's yard, and he saw that her house had been torn apart just as theirs had, by Seraph, who had not anticipated that some of their victims would gain power from the attack, and sought any crumb of information they might find about these dangerous little viral particles. Pam broke into a run and disappeared into the house. Martin saw in his mind's eye a flashing image of a car key, but knew that her heart was taking her to her old room and the rooms of those she loved, and he saw her looking at the melted, deranged ruin of her home, and knew that she was feeling the same horror that he had, the same anguish at seeing something so much a part of herself made so ugly. Nobody spoke. Nobody needed to. They could hear her rage in their minds, Even Martin could hear it, and a moment later could also hear the increasing roar of wings and the forlorn, eager cries that grew louder as the Nighthawks, seeing her terror like a bright star in a void, found them again. From the house then, silence. She'd become aware of what her emotions were doing. Nobody moved. Not 100 feet overhead, the creatures swarmed, and from the dark woods all around now came the chuckling of outriders. They had begun marching this way, working their steel fangs. The truck stood in the drive, but when they drew near it, they found that it was peppered with tiny craters. Farther down the driveway were heaps of something, the remains of people. There was no way to tell. As they got into the double cab, Pam tried the key. "We need a miracle, thanks," she muttered. The truck's engine growled. There was a huge crash, and the ceiling was crushed enough to knock Martin's head forward, which was fortunate because enormous claws came ripping through the metal, ripping and clutching. "Keep down, Dad!" The engine ground again. "Come on," Pam said. It was a double cab, and Trevor and Mike had gotten in the back. Trevor came forward between the seats as more of the huge Nighthawks landed around them, their great heads thrusting, their beaks lined with narrow teeth, opening wide when they bellowed, then snapping closed with a lethal crack. More landed, and more, until Martin could smell their breath, a mixture of hydrogen sulfide and rotting meat that made your throat burn. Then one of the heads thrust forward and crashed through the windshield, and the teeth slashed toward Martin. From between the seats, Trevor fired the disc-shaped weapon. There was no report. The head simply flew apart, the upper and lower halves of the beak whirling against the opposite doors, the eyes exploding into a dust of glass and gelatin, and the tongue fluttering in the ruined face as the creature shot backward and ended up squalling on its back in the driveway, its 50-foot wings flapping furiously, hammering the ground so hard that the truck rocked with every great convulsion. With a thunder of howls, the rest of them took off, rising as mayflies do from a spring brook, but monstrous. "Thank you, God," Pam said as the truck finally started. She put it into drive and accelerated toward the street, driving over the creature, which snapped and crackled and squalled beneath the bouncing vehicle. "Sorry about that," she said. They went down to Harrow in the ravaged truck and changed there to another one, Bobby's police car, which stood open on Main and School. The keys were still in the ignition, and it had a quarter tank of gas. Also, between the front seats, a sawed-off shotgun. They got in, Martin behind the wheel. They rode in silence down an empty Highway 36, passing an occasional motionless car, but otherwise meeting not the slightest sign of life. "That's a terrible weapon," Martin said to Trevor. "It's nearly empty," Trevor replied. "The light is coming," Mike said. "We need to hurry." Martin scanned the sky, looking for some sign of an orange disk. He saw nothing, but he stepped on the gas, driving the police interceptor up to 120, then 130. Bobby kept the thing in good shape. "Take a right," Mike said. "I thought it was in Smith Center." "The monument's on 191. Martin turned north on 281. The fields were fallow, the country totally empty. "Left," Mike said. Another mile, and Martin saw the little monument just off the road. A short distance from it was a small building. "Okay," Mike said. "You got it. Now what?" They got out. Martin carried the shotgun. Mike took it. "That's an 8-shot semi," he said. "Not 7. "It's loaded?" "I know that." Martin went to the chapel, a white, portable building, its siding weathered. The door was unlocked. He pushed it open. Inside were a few pews, a table, and a cross on the wall behind it. He noticed that this was not an ordinary Christian cross. Christ lay upon it, but the four limbs of the cross were of equal length. He wondered who might have done that in rural Kansas, made it into such a very ancient symbol. For the solar cross marked the solstices and the equinoxes and related to the greatest depths of human memory and knowledge from the time when we did not think like we do now, but made wonders in the world because we were surrendered to God and thus acting on exquisite instinct, not plodding thought.
"Who is she?" Pam asked.
For a moment, Martin was confused. Then he saw her too, a shadow, standing in the corner of the chapel, so still that she at first appeared to be little more than a thickening of the dark. But he could see her eyes there in the corner of the room, her gleaming eyes and her slimness. Jennifer Maisel sprang at him. One second he was wondering if the figure was even alive, the next he had been slammed to the floor. Her hands came around his throat, closed. His head felt as if it was going to explode. At that same moment, thick light surged in the windows and the door with the force of a tidal wave, causing the glass to shatter and the door to slam all the way across the chapel, where it hit the wall and dropped the cross to the floor. Martin looked directly into Maisel's face, into eyes that bulged until the contact lenses popped out, revealing the reptile eyes of the seraph. In the light that was all around them, he could see the kids moving with method and direction, and could hear the whispering of their minds. Mike pulled Maisel's head back, her mouth opened, and her long black tongue came out as she screamed. Trevor thrust the shotgun into her mouth and pulled the trigger, and her lithe body shot backward in a shower of green blood. The head burst.
"But the light! Don't think, Martin!" Pam yelled. "Just let yourself happen, Dad!"
As he took his attention away from his mind and into his body, he felt his soul return also, and knew that the light had been taking him so stealthily that he hadn't even realized it. Then Pam marched into the corner where Maisel had been standing and simply disappeared. For a moment, Martin thought she'd gone through a concealed gateway, but when he heard echoing footsteps, he understood. Cunning doors like this were seen in some Egyptian temples he'd worked on, but especially in Peru, where there were many of them in old Cuzco, doors that to this day only the Inca knew. But to find one here in Kansas, well, he would have been surprised once. Concentrating on his breath, on the way his body felt as he moved, leaving his thoughts and his fears behind, he found that he could move through the light easily and without danger. The kids weren't even concerned by it. He crossed the ruined chapel with the others, walking straight into the corner, feeling it give way, seeing the darkness, then finding his footing on steep black steps. They had defeated the light, and if only mankind had recognized his own soul before it was too late, the whole world would have been able to do the same thing. But the seraph had infiltrated us with the lie that we were a body only, that there was no soul that was admissible to understanding and to science, and that science itself was a strange exploration, having nothing to do with the kingdom of God, when, in fact, there was no real science that did not address heaven and Satori. As they went down, the air changed, growing thicker and warmer, beginning to smell stifling. This was the air of Abaddon, air as it would be everywhere in this world of theirs very soon. It was heavier, their air, and would be filling low places first. He was last in line, going down the iron steps. Faint light came from below, from above, now only darkness. They went down for a long time, and Martin remembered the part of Wiley's book about Al's descent.
he had been taken miles into the earth. As the light from below got brighter, it took on a blue cast, and the narrow shaft they were descending became more distinct.
"It's our guide," Mike said.
Martin knew that the blue light of souls was also the color of good worlds, and that Abaddon was brown. But the human earths were palest blue, the color of their waters and their skies, and the glow of their dead.
"Are we sure?" Martin asked.
They were a good 200 steps down, and he was beginning to feel a distinct sense of claustrophobia in the narrow space. He forced himself not to think of the depth or the closeness. He'd found reading Wiley's description of Al's descent beneath Cheyenne Mountain to be almost unendurable, so vivid was the sense of being enclosed in rock. And he could never forget the feeling he'd had here earlier.
"Oh, my God!"
It was Pam calling up from below.
"What?"
He reached the bottom of the steps. At first, he was only aware of color. Gold, green, red, tan. He couldn't understand what he was seeing. Then he could. "This is the most extraordinary room in the world." He'd seen it before, of course, but not in the body, not with all the vividness of his living eyes.
"Back down, Dad. Try to put your mind away."
"I can't put my mind away. Don't you see what this is? It's where we saw the hieroglyphics. But now we're here in the flesh, and it's all so vivid and so real. This is the most superb example of Old Kingdom bas-relief on the planet, and it's in the middle of the United States.
Dad, listen to me. If you don't just let it take you over, we're in trouble. Because we're not in the United States, Dad. This is Abaddon, and the second they realize that we're here, we are done. We've come through a gateway. We're still on Earth, but in the physics of Abaddon."
"Come on," Mike said. "We've got work to do, stuff to figure out."
Martin followed him across the room where Al North had been deprived of his life and his soul. He followed them through a low doorway, which was the source of the light, which was a living light that penetrated the flesh and made you weep to feel it upon your body. Then he saw why. He was in a cavern, blue-lit like a submarine cave just touched by sun from the surface. Before them stretched a sea of glass tubes, each 3 feet long, all plugged into huge black sockets, all living, exact replicas of the images on the wall of the Temple of Dendera. Except these tubes were sparking with life, and you could see the lights inside them leaping and jumping and struggling, causing the whole room to flicker continuously. Slowly, Trevor, then Pam, and Mike went to their knees. Martin followed them, because the light shining on them was not just alive, but richly alive, and they could see millions of summer mornings, dew on the flowers of the world, signs of struggle and happiness, and hear, also, a roar of voices that was vast. The flower of mankind was here.
"What do we do now, Dad?"
"I have no idea."